Welcome to the podcast, hosted by the Journal of Healthcare Contracting. And now, our host, Scott Adams.
For those of you who've been with us for all of the podcasts in the Back to Wellness series, welcome back to episode 4. If you're new to the series, there's 3 other podcasts in it. This series is sponsored by McKesson Medical and brought to you by the Journal of Healthcare Contracting. I'm your host, Scott Adams, today, and we thank McKesson immensely for sponsoring these 4 podcasts. We couldn't bring content like this to you on a regular weekly basis without sponsors like them. Today we are talking about, we actually probably could have done this podcast first because it kind of engulfs everything that we've talked about to date. But a lot of this one's going to be around infection prevention. And today's topic is infection prevention in a time of COVID-19. We have an expert on clinical science, and his name is Mark Oliver Wright. He is with PDI. He is the liaison for PDI for clinical sciences. And Mark, I'm so happy to have you on the podcast today.
Oh, thanks for the invitation, Scott. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, it's been a crazy few months, and we're obviously going through some crazy times in America right now. But obviously, as practices start coming back online and everything around COVID and everything else, we thought that it would be good to put some content out for mainly providers who are going to be reopening practices. And so I got a list of questions for you today. I'd love to talk with you about, have some conversation. We can get into whatever you want. But let me just hit you with the first one, which is, how has COVID-19 changed the way we think about infection prevention?
Well, that's a great question. Thanks, Scott. The interesting thing is that we keep talking about returning to a new normal. And yet at the same time, we don't know what that new normal is, what it looks like, or what it actually means. And so for infection prevention, who has really been tasked with the preparedness for events like this, it's new to us too. So the first thing to keep in mind is that COVID-19 is something new. And I think that's something that gets lost in the shuffle and in the conversation of things. First of all, it's not like anything we've seen before. We often like to look back to past outbreaks and epidemics and say, well, this is what happened with the flu in 1918, so this is what could happen with corona in 2020. But the fact is that a lot of things have changed in the last 102 years, and these are completely different viruses. So while it's good to reflect on what we've learned over past experience, we can't let that cloud our judgment in terms of what is going to happen. And what we need to do, and what infection preventionists have really been challenged to do, is to be proactive and responsive and pragmatic in their approach to being able to provide the safest healthcare to the patients that need it in a wide variety of settings. So if you're working in infection prevention in an integrated healthcare delivery system where you have maybe a large acute care facility, a smaller community hospital, outpatient physician offices, or maybe some surgery centers and home health and rehabilitation, you've got to look at the context of what is going on with coronavirus in your local and regional setting, as well as nationally and internationally, and make those kind of tough decisions about what can we do to ensure the safest care possible for our patients, as well as keeping your frontline providers safe as well. And so what's really important to that is to be well-informed, to be adaptive, to use science, and to be able to make these relatively quick decisions when you don't have all the information you'd like to have. So for example, I'd like to know the precise mechanisms of disease transfer with COVID-19. And we think we have a good understanding of that now. We've got models based off that and recommendations on the kind of personal protective equipment and building engineering things that need to be in place to make it a safe environment for both patients and healthcare workers. But that information might evolve. Similarly, as treatments come online, as vaccine development proceeds as it's inclined to do, we're going to have to continue to be adaptive and responsive to new information as it comes in. There's something really unsettling about, going to work, not knowing precisely what it is that is going to happen that day. or how things are going to change. And the nice thing about infection prevention is that it's a discipline that you become a master of, or a jack of all trades and really a master of none. You need to have a good understanding of how things work throughout the healthcare delivery system in order to be an informed and engaged subject matter expert when you're needed. So infection preventionists have really, you know, stepped up this past year and really have been on the forefront of these decisions and of these operational considerations that affect the day-to-day lives of everyone in their organization, as well as the patients in their community.
Yeah, you talk about adapting, and I know you guys on your side have definitely had to adapt over the last 3 or 4 months as the amount of product that's just flowing through your organization and into distribution and out to the caregivers has, I want to say quadruple, but I'm sure it's probably more like tenfold what it was. And kind of talking about that, obviously physician offices and ambulatory care surgery centers are going to have to really plan a little different going forward. What in your opinion are some of the things they need to do to be preparing to, you know, operate and to use your term, or actually what everybody's using now, the new norm?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So the first thing when you're talking about, for example, medical supplies, there's a combination of two things, right? You have an increase in demand for certain things like personal protective equipment and disinfectants. And that increased demand has sort of filtered upstream in the sense that it can cause manufacturing delays or potential for back orders. And then even further up the stream is you're looking at raw materials and the distribution of goods across an international marketplace. So, you know, at the start of COVID-19, a lot of our personal protective equipment was manufactured in Asia, which made it difficult for some of those materials to get to the U.S. when we needed them. The nice thing about this is that these kinds of challenges provide opportunities for innovation. So one of the things that has come out is the CDC and NIOSH have developed an application or an app called the NIOSH PPE Tracker, which is available for free in the Google Play or App Store. And what it does is that it allows a individual practice or acute care hospital or community hospital or nursing home to be able to enter the stock of supply that they have, the stock of supply that they use over a prescribed period of time. And then that app will continually update and provide you with information in terms of how much PPE do you have? How many days of supplies do you have that you need? And when are you most likely to run out? Now, this is good in the setting that if you're faced with manufacturing delays or back orders, then you have the opportunity to adjust and respond accordingly and to be able to develop contingency plans for one or more alternatives if you need them, or to evaluate conservation plans. You know, so one of the interesting things that has come out this year is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration suspended their fit testing, some elements of their fit testing requirements around personal protective equipment and respiratory protection. And some places have innovated to the point of reuse and reprocessing of what has historically been single-use personal protective equipment, like the N95 respirators. This, of course, is something that we've done out of necessity. But the good thing is that as we develop these ideas, then that information gets vetted, published in terms of white papers and guidelines and recommendations, and other people can learn from them. So what I would say is, as an individual working in the healthcare section, the best thing you can do is to keep your eyes and your ears open. There's a lot of innovation that's going on out there in terms of identifying opportunities for conserving your personal protective equipment, how to maximize the utilization of your available medical supplies, and what to do when you are on the brink of running out. That's unfortunately the situation that we've been in, both from a raw material and a demand supply, but it really allows us to innovate when we need to.
Yeah, I would. I think as the host, I'm allowed to say this, and I think that, you know, you can depend on your distribution partner as well, in helping you with a ton of this. I know
McKesson's the sponsor of the podcast, so I can't let them say that on it. But I definitely think 100%. You know, in any time in our history of the industry, distribution has become more important maybe than it ever has been, especially given the back orders on PPE and having to allocate and do all of those fun things, which we all hate, but it's really to protect the caregivers ultimately, so that we have product where it needs to be, when it needs to be. Let me ask you this. I always learn stuff on these, and that's why I love doing podcasts, you know, like the app thing, for example. I would have no idea there would have been an app out there to help with that. That's amazing that that's there and that they can use it. What are some other ways that they can stay informed about COVID-19 activities, you know, in the communities they serve?
Yeah. So that's a great question. So it's, what's the most important thing you can do is to be fully engaged and informed in what's going on with COVID-19 in your region, the community that you serve. And the best resource for that information is going to be your local, regional, or state public health agency. So many, many states have been providing daily updates on the status of COVID-19 in the communities that they serve. So not only are they receiving information from your particular healthcare organization, but they're receiving them from healthcare organizations throughout the area. They're aggregating that data and information. They're communicating that upstream to entities such as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And they're trending this information because they have to provide policymakers with the information they need to make key decisions about when it is safe to relax some of the restrictions that have been in place, or when those restrictions need to be reinvigorated or brought back. So that is the most reliable, consistently available information that you can have, and to have that ongoing active communication with those local public health agencies is vital. If you're part of a larger healthcare delivery system, your infection prevention program is already doing that. And hopefully you're receiving regular updates from within your organization. And then a nice resource that I like to point folks to, and this came out very early in the outbreak, right about the time as the first case showed up in the United States, is that there's this excellent resource that comes from the Center for Systems Science and Engineering at Johns Hopkins University. And if you just type in a search engine, Johns Hopkins University COVID-19 map, it brings up this wonderful worldwide map of cases that are being updated from multiple reliable sources. And it allows you to actually drill down in the United States to the county specific level. And it will tell you the number of cases, the number of people that have recovered, the number of people that have died. And with that information, you're able to identify the trends within the regions that you serve as a healthcare organization. So you can get a real lay of the land of what is going on today, as opposed to what was going on last week, last month, or last year.
That's unbelievable. Technology and information. And the one thing that we've learned as a media company over the course of these last 4 or 5 months is how much people are looking for content and information, and how important the conversation is and communication is. And I think that's probably true in all walks of life. For sure. But man, when we're in a pandemic like this and things going on, the more communication and education you can get, the better. I'm going to shift gears on you now and talk a little bit about staffing. You know, what about staffing? How can practice managers do, what can they do to keep their staff safe?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. You know, this is probably in my career of infection prevention, one of the things that I have consistently tried to learn from with every organizational or national issue as it pertains to infection prevention. You cannot communicate with your staff enough in times like this. We sometimes think that because everyone is in the healthcare field, everyone is equally informed, and nothing could be further from the truth. And in fact, I think hyper-communicating is probably the best thing that a practice manager can do for their staff. The fact is that silence or lack of communication breeds anxiety, fear, and speculation. If you're not talking to them, your staff are going to go out and find information on their own. And the problem with that is that not all information is created equal. You know, there are reliable sources of information and evidence-based information, like from the Centers for Disease Control or your state public health agencies, or peer-reviewed medical literature. And then there's everything else. So it's really, really important to have this open dialogue. As a practice manager, you can't possibly be expected to know all the answers. And there's nothing wrong with saying to someone, you know, I don't know, but let me look into that and get back to you. People respect that immensely, especially when you follow through. The key is, though, is to have that reliable information. So the first thing is to make sure that the information you're getting is from a reliable resource, whether it is an internal communication from your infection preventionist or infection prevention program, if it's regional or local information from your public health agencies or the Centers for Disease Control, that's good. But I would be really hesitant to read something on social media necessarily and say and accept it as truth at face value. So the first thing that you need to do is you need to make sure that your staff are very clear about what it is that they need to do to protect themselves, as well as protect their colleagues. So, for example, staff should be performing some form of self-monitoring before they come into work every day. And this would be as simple as, you know, taking a temperature check. Even better is to actively screen your employees on site for fever or symptoms before each shift, just to make sure that they themselves are not coming to work ill. This is something that we've seen with nursing homes and long-term care facilities. It seems that there have been instances where staff have gotten sick, have continued working, and this is not new to healthcare. It's not new to coronavirus. We are a group of people that are committed to our jobs in our field, and we want to be there. And unfortunately, sometimes we come into work when we shouldn't be coming into work. So making sure that our employees are screened and that they're only coming to work when they're not symptomatic. And then, of course, making sure that you have guidelines, either that you've developed if you're a standalone practice or if you're part of a larger healthcare system, that address self-quarantining. And, should an employee of yours have been exposed to a known coronavirus case? What are the guidelines for what they should be doing? Should they be doing more aggressive self-monitoring, or are they supposed to be quarantined? And if so, for how many days? And then, of course, when staff do get sick, there is a quarantine period that they need to not be coming into work. And if that is, if there's a lot of coronavirus in your community, that could really run a gamut through your staffing profile. So to have these staffing mitigation strategies available, either at the specific practice level or at the health system level, what would you do if 10% of your employees were unable to come into work for 2 weeks? Obviously, you want to educate and communicate the clinic and organizational policies and procedures for engineering controls. You know, which rooms should persons under investigation or PUIs be seen in? Do they have negative pressure? If not, what are we doing to make sure that air is properly recirculated before we use it again? And as well as the placement and utilization of personal protective equipment and reuse if it's appropriate and necessary. All of this really goes to a greater understanding of what it is that as a practice we're going to do to ensure that our staff are safe. What are we going to do to make sure that our staff remain healthy? And when they're not healthy, how do we make sure that they are not coming into work and exposing their colleagues as well as our patients?
You know, being a caregiver isn't hard enough. Now we have to add all of this fun stuff to it. It's just amazing to me, and they are the heroes in all of this for sure. I would also say that the distribution folks that have been getting product out for the last 3 months and working, you know, countless hours to get product to these accounts are heroes as well. Every time I see one in a truck, out delivering product, I try to stop and just thank them. What are you seeing with, you know, medical supply distributors? Are they operating the same as they did before COVID?
Not that I've seen. Anyone that is very fortunate soul, they must be selling office supplies and not medical supplies. No, I think you've got a couple of things going on. You've got this evolving, flexing demand and availability of certain product lines, whether you're talking about personal protective equipment or disinfectants, ventilator equipment. You have these rolling shortages and this need to offer viable alternatives. And sometimes there's not a direct crosswalk. So if one company makes something that no other company makes, and that item is no longer available, distributors, infection preventionists, and manufacturers are all being tasked with, okay, what can or should I use as an alternate? Because the process of the need doesn't go away. If you don't have N95 respirators, it doesn't mean you stop wearing any masks when you go into a suspect COVID room. That would be irresponsible, to say the least. So having to identify, okay, what are my other viable alternatives? What are the risks and benefits of going with this alternative practice? Getting that product available and distributed to the locations that it needs to get to, and then educating staff on the new process. So you've got this sort of constant shakeup that affects all aspects of medical care delivery from manufacturer to the patient bedside. And the distributors are the ones that are stuck right there in the middle, responding to both the manufacturer needs as well as the customer or client needs.
Yeah, I've talked to so many of them, obviously as the publisher of the industry magazine that goes out to the distribution reps every month, and you can hear it in their voice how tired they are, and it's just so hard for them to try to get the message to the end user of why things are on allocation or back order. Right. And it's not obviously not distribution's fault or the manufacturer's fault. It just is what it is. And they're trying to convey that. I genuinely can't say it enough how thankful I am for those folks. To get back kind of to the facilities though, and talk about, you know, what about the environment there? What should the locations be doing to keep their facilities clean and safe kind of in the short term and in the long term?
Sure, that's a great question. So the first thing, specifically as it relates to COVID, is you want to first assess your facility engineering controls and your mitigation strategies if needed. So what rooms do you have that have negative pressure where coronavirus patients should be preferentially seen and evaluated? If you don't have any negative pressure rooms, number one, should you be seeing persons under investigation or suspected coronavirus cases in your facility? And if so, what are you going to do to mitigate that change? You can't just pop in a negative, you can't turn a room negative pressure in a day. You can do some mitigation strategies like HEPA filtration, et cetera. You know, so although person-to-person spread is considered the predominant transmission route for COVID-19, the viability of novel coronavirus on surfaces has been as long as 2 to 3 days on plastic and stainless steel. And the EPA continues to update its list of products that meet the agency standard for use against SARS-CoV-2. That list is called List N. So if any practice managers out there are not familiar with this, if you just type into your search engine, EPA and List N, it brings up this comprehensive list of all surface disinfectants that have been approved for use against COVID-19. And that's based off the emerging pathogen, viral pathogen claim that many manufacturers have secured. You know, the good thing about this virus is that it's not terribly difficult to kill off of a surface. We're not talking about something that is, I guess the best comparison I can think of is this is not the same as a Clostridium difficile spore that only, you know, one or two chemical agents are effectively good at killing in the environment. SARS-CoV-2 is thought to be easily killed with the right combination of disinfectants and making sure that you're using it for the appropriate wet contact or kill time. So whatever time it is on the label or time on that list end, so list end actually gives you the amount of time that the surface needs to remain wet with that disinfectant in order to be thought to kill COVID-19. So the next thing you need to do is you need to evaluate your current standards and practices on surface disinfection for clinical and non-clinical environments. What do I mean by non-clinical environment in a practice group? I would be thinking of things like waiting areas and public bathrooms, and that you might want to modify this accordingly. So pre-coronavirus, you might have had your public restrooms cleaned one, two, maybe three times a day, cleaned and disinfected. The question is that enough? There have not been specific guidelines that have gone out with the degree of frequency for non-clinical areas. But I think a very good pragmatic approach would be to evaluate this in the context of what is the activity of coronavirus like in my community? How many persons under investigation do I expect or plan to see in my facility? How am I operationalizing patient flow to get them seen as quickly as possible and to keep them out of these common waiting areas or non-clinical areas? And then to evaluate how often these surfaces need to be cleaned and disinfected. So the other thing to consider, and I realize that this is, we should have been doing this all along to a certain extent, but we need to consider equipment or surfaces potentially previously overlooked. So for example, you might know that your exam rooms are cleaned and disinfected after every patient encounter, and that's hopefully exactly what's happening, and that's exactly what should happen. But perhaps you're not thinking, how often are my staff using personal electronic devices? And how often are those personal electronic devices being cleaned? Or to be looking at things like your wireless computers on wheels or your WOWs. How often are those keyboards, that mouse, getting cleaned and disinfected and making sure that it is sufficient and enough? So non-clinical areas formerly might have only needed to be cleaned, you know, once a day, but might need more frequent attention in this setting.
Unbelievable the amount of things that are coming about because of this virus. And so Mark, let me ask you this question about how practice managers need to be working in within patient scheduling and patient flow throughout the practice, because that's got to be something that's going to be on the forefront of everyone's mind, how they manage this process of reopening.
Probably the most important thing that I need to do as a practice manager getting to open up in this new normal is to evaluate what are the patients that my practice is going to see. Is that different than what it was before? Does that include persons who may be persons under investigation? And I'm not talking about necessarily asymptomatic COVID carriers, which they themselves present their own unique risk. But are you expected to evaluate patients who are coming in with viral respiratory illness of an unknown origin? You know, I've had a fever and cough for 3 days. I'd like to come see my doctor. Are they coming to see you? The first thing is to establish their appropriate level of necessary medical care. And this is where we've really gotten creative in the last couple of months. This is something that has started before coronavirus, but now is certainly being tapped into more. Telehealth or virtual healthcare visits are a great way, a reimbursable way, to see and evaluate patients without actually having them necessarily come into your clinic. So if that is an appropriate level of necessary medical care and you have the technology and the means and the resources to do it, that's the best option for you. But it really is after we've established the necessary level of medical care. A lot of patients, when they are first reaching out to their healthcare providers, are a lot sicker than they should be. That they need a higher level of care. We know that there's been this silent hypoxia with a lot of coronavirus cases that get admitted to acute care facilities. The CDC actually has some really good resource algorithms for patient triage. And in fact, I really should highlight the information that the CDC has specifically as it pertains to ambulatory settings. So they have updated their guidance documents specifically for outpatient ambulatory care, and that is available on the CDC website. But it includes information about algorithms for assessing the necessary degree of medical care that a patient needs. But once you've determined that, let's say you have, as a practice manager, determined that your setting is one that is going to see and evaluate persons under investigation or those that might be active, symptomatic cases of where COVID-19 is part of the diagnosis differential, you need to prepare your facility for safe triage. And everyone needs to prepare themselves for potential walk-ins. So having really clear multilingual visual alerts instructing patients what to do when they arrive at your facility. Here's a respiratory etiquette station. Put on a mask. Perform hand hygiene. Those sorts of steps can go a long way to diminishing the potential risk of transmission within your facility. You need to ensure that you have available supplies for patients at the entrances and throughout the facility, wherever a patient might come in. If you've got a main entrance, but you've got a side door, you want to make sure that respiratory etiquette stations are at both. And then, of course, if you're evaluating potential COVID patients, you want to ensure that there's good physical separation in the waiting areas, or better yet, prompt rooming upon arrival and really good coordination around. If we suspect that this patient might have COVID-19 and they're coming to our facility, how can we get them into our facility, into the exam area where they can be safely evaluated by our healthcare professionals while minimally contaminating the environment around them as well as any common areas so that we're protecting ourselves, our staff, and our patients.
Man, that is a wealth of information there. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast today and sharing all of that with us. I know the audience will get a ton out of it. Mark, thank you so much for being with us today, man.
Thank you very much, Scott. It was really my pleasure.
As we close out this four-part series around the new norm and opening up practices across the country, I just want to thank all of you who've been a part of all four and listened. I want to really reiterate McKesson for being the sponsor of this podcast series. The content, in my opinion, that we were able to get out of these subject matter experts was excellent. Again, thank you so much, Journal Healthcare Contracting. We'll be putting out more content like this, so be looking for it in the daily news. And everybody out there, be safe and good luck with the reopening of America.